Okay, this is Cameron and Bob Dobbs, Cameron McEwen and Bob Dobbs again on Tuesday night for me, November 10th, 2020, in the early morning after Cameron has slept off November 10th, so he's into November 11th, 2020. So that's the timing we're starting with. It's 2:40 in the morning my time in Hawaii. So Cameron has read through my book and quotes. It's just a very long article, 187 computer pages, do I say? PDF pages? What are these pages?
Yeah, well, there's pages of the document and there's PDF pages. They're slightly different. The document is 187 pages and the PDF is 189.
Oh, okay. So it's pretty close. So
yeah.
I posted this on October 31st, 2020, and I worked on it, August, September, like three months about, and I had help from another guy. Okay, so let's Cameron begin with any ideas he has about it.
Sure. Well, one of the interesting things for me is that you self-consciously use different voices in the essay.
Yes.
And it's sometimes hard to know which one you're using, and it's interesting to think about how the different voices relate. So what I mean by different voices is that you often speak in the voice of the person that you're either citing or talking about. And they themselves may have different voices. So, for example, your presentation of McLuhan is one where he has all sorts of different voices, and your comments about those voices themselves have different voices. And so there's a kind of mirroring effect, which we have to note as we go through your book, and I'm interested to know your thoughts about it as we uncover examples of that.
Great. This is good.
So then another thing I want to just mention at the start is that when I read anything, I'm always interested to know what time is involved, or even more than that, what times, plural, are involved, and the same with space and spaces. So as we go into your book, there are instances where you seem to be talking, let's say, in chronological time. And to me, it doesn't make sense in chronological time. For example, some citation from McLuhan only makes sense in simultaneous time, synchronic time. And so we'll have to sort of ask questions about time and space as we go through the book. And another question related to the voices question, but more in the kind of third person, is the question of who is being talked about, right? So
yes.
There are sections of the book where you use the word people a lot.
Yes.
But it's unclear just who these people are, if they're a mass or if they're individuals together or just what. And to me, the more I ask questions like these of your book, the more interesting the book became. And so I think in a dialogue about it, I believe that I'm going to learn more about you and learn more about McLuhan, but you yourself may find ways to amplify, clarify your own mind.
Yes.
So that'll be interesting as well.
Yes. Very good.
But another a really important question that I'd like us to keep in mind as we go through is what you were doing with this book. So just as an example, one of the things that you talked about in the book is technical thinking or technical reasoning, and eventually getting into the tech body.
Yes.
And so the question might be, well, are you doing something technical, right, which you sometimes contrast with satirical? Or are you doing something related to the technical, like science? Or are you doing science fiction? Or are you doing what you call prophetic poetry?
Yes.
Or are you doing what is called complex clairvoyance? So all of these questions need to be sort of asked about any statement, and then it has to be wondered, well, probably you're sometimes doing the one and sometimes doing the other, and so then how do these relate?
That's right.
Yeah, so I'll just leave it at that. I'd like to, I guess what I'm saying is that when people are thinking, and when they're conducting a good dialogue, probably the most important thing going on is questioning. And questioning not in the sense of necessarily leading to something, but questioning as inherently good and revealing in itself.
Yeah. That's what you'd like to do.
That's all I have to say at the start.
Okay, so that's a very good statement. Do we begin with a question?
Well, what I've done with your book is mark up passages, sometimes have sticky notes in them. And what we could do is just start out on page one and then just sort of keep on going.
Yes.
My preferred way of tackling this thing would be to start a little bit later on around page 40 and go from page 40 to 60 or so, and then go back to page one, because I think that section from 40 to 60 or 65, whatever it is very rich and helps to set out what's going on in your book.
Okay, so let me state my goal, ostensible
mm-hmm.
goal. Did you know about the spring, April, May, June webinars that Paola Granata ran?
No.
Okay, so in April, people were into the lockdown. They had to be, you know, stay in their home and that, in a lot of the places. So he got together, put out an invite to all the McLuhan scholars around the world that he would like to talk to them about what's the meaning of this virus and whatever other stuff that's related to McLuhan. And so he picked three or four each week, or every other week, I can't remember, maybe it was every week, and they'd be around the world, and he'd interview each one, then get them talking, and see if they could use the Zoom medium and make a nice building up of community of McLuhan scholars. So he did that, and I watched, I don't think I missed any, I watched them all, not often live, but after they were done, so I could rewind and stuff. And I was quite, I don't know if I was appalled, but I found it very boring or very tedious or very not worthy of McLuhan. Nobody seemed to be handling the new situation with the COVID virus and lockdown with any of vitality like McLuhan seemed to me would always do. So I was thinking by the end of it that since most of these people were in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, a few younger people in their 20s, new professors and that, or adjunct professors, why would any younger person of different kinds of education, but why would anybody be interested in what they were talking about? Basically, they stuck with the cliche aphorisms of McLuhan: the medium is the message, user is the content, the global village, the tetrad, and media ecology. And for me, there was nothing to attract them, to attract what they were talking about, their ideas, that I had gotten from McLuhan back in the 1560s. Nothing revolutionary. Now, maybe this is too high a demand on people, but I thought, there's no vitality, no authority, no charisma, nothing going on here. And when I did talk to some of the younger people, they kind of agreed with me. They didn't really get much out of it. So then Paola Granata ended up on July 21st, McLuhan's birthday, to do a 12-hour marathon. And he brought back the same people, basically, to be there all day long and interact with everybody. And that occurred. And that didn't create any new spark for me, but it clinched the issue that something had to be done about this. So I put on a mission. I'm going to make McLuhan relevant to today somehow. I didn't know if I could do it. I had a few hints of bringing him up to the present, but I started out just gathering quotations, and I have a good memory for his whole span of work. Then I do a sidebar here. Were there any quotes that I came up with that you didn't know?
I don't know if that was the case, but a few of them I hadn't really thought about in a way that you brought out, and I found that very helpful.
Good. So I've read enough McLuhan to know the good quotes, the esoteric ones, the ones that never discussed. And that was another one of my complaints. No one ever talks about the really neat, juicy quotes that I'm used to looking at that people don't know about. Either they haven't read enough McLuhan or they didn't understand it. And they just kept it to simple basics. So I was trying to find the best and most obscure quotes, but also they had to help me develop my theme. And my theme was to bring McLuhan right up to today and relate McLuhan to this phenomenon that I call the tech body, which has developed between me and my colleagues, esoteric colleagues. And just been talking about it for a year, and so I wondered if I could do it. Okay, so then I gathered together all these quotes. Then, and I typed them up, and I make really sure that my quotes are properly punctuated and grammatically correct. You probably didn't find many spelling mistakes or any grammatical mistakes. Do you recall any?
Well, I've sent a few to Clinton.
Okay,
but they were just minor. I would notice that. There was a letter missing or something. So they were mostly typos that I found. They weren't spelling mistakes.
Right. Okay, so I did that. Then I sent them to a friend in Zurich, Switzerland, who's been studying McLuhan the last couple of years. He came to it late in his life, but he's really being diligent. So I asked him to ask me questions about them. And so I'd have to explain them in an oral, casual way. So we did that. And then he transcribed the written, the spoken parts. And then he sent them back to me, and I had to fine-tune it, make it perfect, his transcription, because he put every mumble and ooh, but it in there. So that took a while to clean that up, make it perfect, but still be conversational. So those are started with the word Bob colon. So Bob speaking. But I don't include Bert's questions, Bert Hill. My answers are not necessarily unique. They just go over what the quote said. So some of them are just pedestrian. So I did that. And so then I now had the quotes and my conversational. So I thought it was neat to have an essay style going through, connecting the quotes, but also have this conversational, so two tracks. And that took a long time to do. My prose part, where I link the quotes and make a story or a narrative, is not jargon-filled. It is rather mundane and plain, just simple to me. You know, I'm not making a novel or anything. So I organized all that, and I felt it worked. I got to where I wanted to go, and I was pretty happy about that. So then I had to put it out to the community, or at least the first part of the community that were interested. And, you know, it's been a couple of weeks. No, it's only been 10 days. And so far I've gotten, quote, friendly reviews. People liked it. So that was good. And that's where we're at now. There's just a few people who've read it. Though I think Clinton said they put it on the New Explorations blog, the New Explorations Journal, is it maybe, blog, and they got a lot of hits. Not that everybody read much of it, but there was some interest in it. And I've noticed a few people that I know have read it using quotes. I know they discovered some new quotes that they liked, and they used them in McLuhan form. So that's good. Get some new stuff out there. And the punchline was, if someone asked me, what did McLuhan say? What was he about? Can you sum up his ideas? And I decided on this quote from Take Today. Don't have the exact page number, but it's around 210 Take Today, where McLuhan is talking about the novel Catch-22. And he says, in Catch-22, we have a situation where, this is approximate, where the war merges with the black market. And so he then, I think it's in italics, he says, this leads to a situation where every financial transaction drips blood. So I thought, that's a fantastic, interesting statement of the way the 20th century has been, if you look at the more violent parts of society and the underground parts. And you're stating a situation.
Not only the 20th century.
Beg your pardon?
Not only the 20th century.
No, but we.
21st as well.
Yes, but these are big wars, big markets, global situation. Maybe the wars and violence has always happened, white and black markets, but it's sort of unique, and entertainment is built off it. So much of entertainment is about these scenarios, the cops and robbers.
Absolutely.
And the war movies.
Absolutely.
So I thought, okay, that's what McLuhan wanted people to realize, because there's been so many movements toward peace, or dreams of peace, all through the 20th century, and dreams of reforming society, all kinds of different inspirations of our situation. So it's an effect, but I point out that the cause and effects merge. And no one knows that quote. I've never met anybody who knew it. So that's so I end the essay saying, okay, so next time someone asks you what McLuhan said, say this quote. So don't say the old cliches. Make people think again. Why would every transaction drip blood? So that, in essence, is what I did. So I now let you ask a question.
Well, I guess what I would say, I don't listen to the sort of webinar that you're talking about simply because I don't find them at all surprising. I think what you were saying is that if you listen to what McLuhan says and attend to what he writes, if you're going to understand it, you have to be open to being surprised.
Yeah.
Right? McLuhan always said, I don't write to put down what I already know. I write in the hope of learning something. And the same with this conversation. So
yes.
When people parrot stuff, as you were saying, that they parroted things about the medium as a message and the global village and stuff, they're not understanding sort of the heart of McLuhan, which has to do with the birth of insight.
Yes. I agree 100% there.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that as we go through your book, we not only find evidence of the birth of insight in the quotations and in what you say about them, but in the exchange between ourselves.
Yes. Yep, the exchange is part of the book.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the heart, I believe, of the electric environment and of what McLuhan often means by technology.
Exactly, correct. Yep. So, go to page 40. Okay, well, what do you think of the opening quote about no conflict? No politician is immune from conflict of interest. You ever seen that quote?
Where are you on that?
That's on page one. There's two quotes at the very beginning.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. So, no, I hadn't. I'm unfamiliar with this interview with David Sohn.
Yes, who was no fan of McLuhan's, an American, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I have no idea who he is. And I've never seen anything of that interview. To me, there's nothing surprising in that quotation. Stuff that he was constantly aware of, even as a kid growing up in Winnipeg. But it's nice to have it in a little package like that.
Yeah, now, the first quote is, to analyze media, you got to have a superior, arrogant attitude. That's a very important quote, because what does that mean, and what's he doing? And I don't think in education they encourage that attitude. You know what I mean?
Right, but I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure that that's what McLuhan was talking about. For example, in the quotation, the word attitude doesn't appear. And so
you mean I have the quotation wrong, or I just said it wrong?
No. The quotation is, the road to understanding media effects begins with arrogant superiority.
Oh, yeah. Right.
If one lacked this sense of superiority, this detachment, it would be quite impossible to write about them. It would be like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramid, which that's a wonderful, wonderful line.
Yeah.
It's, I think, from the Hot and Cold interview. Yeah.
With Gerald Stern.
Yeah. So he doesn't talk about an attitude. And to me, the whole question of what an arrogant superiority is very, very important.
Yes.
One of the things that I hope we'll get into a lot in the book is that McLuhan often talks in terms of figure and ground, or of cliche and archetype, and of center and margin, and many, many other things, where for him, it's very important to understand the set of permutations between these pairs, so that what is cliche can also be archetype.
Yes.
And what the difference is between them also varies. So you can have something that is cliche that is figure to archetypal ground, but the difference between that figure and ground can vary, right? And so you have a whole set of variations of these pairs. And the difference between the various instances of these pairs might be called identification, or marking, or a privileging, or a valorizing of one configuration of them.
Yes.
And to me, the key to arrogant superiority is the idea that this kind of marking and privileging is always present, but it's a variable.
Yeah.
And it may be that one of the things that has prevented us from rigorous thinking when it comes to the humanities and the social sciences is that we've failed to understand this, what might be called this arrogant superiority to the possible modulations of figure and ground and center and margin, etc. Right? And so when he says if one lacked this sense of superiority, this detachment, it would be quite impossible to write about them. Later you mention Satellite Man.
Yes.
And the conductor, right? And
yep.
For me, the Satellite Man and the conductor has to do with this superiority that is always present in the modulations of our perceptions, but is unknown in the humanities and social sciences. And therefore, they never get to rigor.
Yeah. Very good. Well said.
Thank you.
So that opening quote, you have the superiority, arrogance. And then he makes, to most people, I think, back in the 70s, maybe not so much now, to say that every politician has a conflict of interest. You're going to get a lot of protests from politicians. So that was a good example of him doing that and ruffling the feathers of people.
It's a good example of the application of arrogant superiority.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's arrogant superiority is always there, but it's either unconscious or not admitted, right? So that when the politician has a conflict of interest, the last thing that politician is going to do is admit to the sort of superiority that is embedded in what they're doing.
Yes.
Right? They're privileging a certain way of being that is eminently questionable, but their role depends on not questioning it.
Yeah.
Or at least, if they question it themselves, preventing others from questioning it.
Yes. Okay, so that was, I thought, was a great quote to start off, and it illustrated the first quote. And I knew it was an obscure quote. I think David Sohn, when I went through the archives, he was an American businessman, not a professor or anything, who just had a real enthusiasm about McLuhan. And occasionally he'd be written up in his local town as a McLuhan enthusiast. So he shows up with McLuhan, and he probably has no avenue to get the interview published. But I got a transcript that Mark Stewart did, and George gave it to me, George Thompson, and there's a lot of other good stuff in it. And it was McLuhan talking to a curious, won't say average, but a curious businessman. The people that McLuhan used to say, you know, feel the effects of the new media immediately. So it was an example of McLuhan not just being an academic. He was an advisor to everybody.
Sure.
Which I liked about McLuhan, so that's a good example of that interview.
I quite agree. And I notice how that relates to this question of superiority.
Yeah.
McLuhan could not fixate himself to a certain mask, certain role.
Right.
He couldn't be just an academic or just a business consultant or just the father in a family or something. He, for him, the putting on of a mask and taking off the mask and going to another mask was the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
And he knew that this was something that everybody always does, is constantly doing, but it's not admitted and it's not applied to our own thinking. And it's because we refuse this application of what we're always doing that we don't get to anything interesting in the humanities and social sciences.
Yes. Perfect. Very good point. You got two bingos there, Cameron, already.
Well, thank you.
So, yes, no, people, enjoy the variety of McLuhan. Enjoy his...
Absolutely.
He's every man. You know, when Barry Nevitt and Morris McLuhan, Marshall's brother, did that book, Who Was Marshall McLuhan, or Who Is Marshall McLuhan? I think it was. They interview a lot of friends. And the book is dedicated to HCE, which refers to Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker and Finney's Wake, who's also Here Comes Everybody. I think that was a great understanding of one of them or both of them, that that's what McLuhan was. He was HCE, Here Comes Everybody. He figured out how to circulate in all the worlds of society, like a newspaper, the cross-section of society. And that would be a modern observer role of traditional artist. We were seeing a person observe and put themselves into all kinds of strange situations that other people would be very timid to do. So he was HCE, and I think that's who Barry means when he dedicates it, but it also means everybody anyways. But I like the fact the book was dedicated to Marshall as HCE, and you just explained how he was, and we are HCE, but we don't we aren't very articulate about it, about the process of being HCE.
Oh, it's mostly put aside as, I mean, if people have any awareness of it at all, they just talk about the masks themselves, which is the message, and they don't talk about the medium between the masks or between the messages, which for McLuhan was the heart of the matter.
Yeah, that's a good point. The people talked about the content and basically had emotional responses to people's masks and criticized people's masks. Too subjective, their response to the medium.
Yep. Yeah, the criticisms can't be cogent if they're simply talking at the level of content, because the content always comes in some context. And if you're not aware of the relationship between the content and the context, then it's just superficial.
Yeah, that's right. Hypocrisy. Hypocrite lecturer.
Yep.
Hypocrite.
Correct.
Bon vivant. Lecturer's reader. That's what...
Yeah, that was Baudelaire.
Yeah, 1857 or so. But people... The main mass may be that people want themselves to be... regarded as a success of life, is to be a bon vivant, to have lived here and enjoyed life. But you don't see much of that consciously.
I would say that I would say that the main mask is the unquestioned mask. All right, people want to present a face. They don't care what face it is, as long as it's taken to be a non-anxious face,
yes.
A non-self question phase, right?
Yeah.
So you can be a priest, or a maverick or whatever, and the main thing, the trick to existence is to present that mask or role as self-convinced.
Yeah, a cool knowing mask.
Correct.
And I was just thinking, that's phatic communion, isn't it? Phatic communication.
Maybe. Yeah.
You're a good fat. Remember McLuhan had that quote? I love the way he nods. He really communicates.
That's right. That might even have been a New Yorker cartoon.
Yeah, I don't. I see it as just a comment in Culture's Our Business. It was a comment on an ad.
I don't think
it was in quotes. Quotation marks. But anyways, it's a good one. Yeah, you're
absolutely
right. It might have been a cartoon. For some reason in my head, it doesn't. Now, he could do that. He could take a cartoon and then put it the line somewhere else and not indicate it was a cartoon.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He didn't care about that too much.
Right. He would quote from Finnegan's Wake and not acknowledge sometimes.
Uh-huh. And very seldom did McLuhan get his quotes correct.
That's right.
He didn't really care about that at all.
Did you ever find There's No Police Like Holmes?
In Finnegan's Wake?
In anywhere, anything Joyce wrote.
No.
Yeah, nobody found it. Barry Nevitt was always looking for it. Occasionally check in. Did you find it yet, Bob? No. And you would look for lines in Finnegan's Wake that weren't written literally that, but somehow said that.
Exactly.
But I never found one. So it's very interesting. Where did he? Is it some joke that Frank Budgen did? You know, the longtime friend of Joyce, that's in some obscure biography or something. You know, it's typical. McLuhan would hide something like that.
I'll have to take a look. That's an interesting question, actually.
Yeah, if you went to a Joyce scholar, not a McLuhanite, see if what they can, you know, a Joyce professor, someone knows Joyce's works well, they might know exactly where it is. It
mm-hmm.
could be in a biography of one of Joyce's friends.
Sure.
So we are still looking for that one. There's No Police Like Holmes. No Place Like Home.
Right.
And I don't even know if I got it right, but it's something like that.
No, you did. You got it right.
Okay. All right, so that was good. Now let's go to page 40, or approximately what you're...
Just before we do that, let's just go to the bottom of page one.
Yeah.
You've got these two quotations that sort of illustrate each other. And then at the bottom, you've got a remark. And you say that... you're making a Marshall McLuhan kit of quotations nobody knows about. and that you say that he said to get out of this cul-de-sac of 50s stuff that they repeat ad nauseum, the medium is the message, global village, et cetera. And that kind of, that gets to what you were saying about the webinar, that these phrases were trotted out as sort of well-known waymarkers that one didn't have to think about and could just use as coin of the realm or something. I would say there's two interesting things in what you're saying here. One is the cul-de-sac. One of the ways in which I think McLuhan is very, very interesting is that he takes seriously something that most people want to avoid, and that is the cul-de-sac of thought.
Yeah.
Right? If somebody brings up the question of roles and masks in life, for example, most people don't like to take this very far, because the person asking the question, of course, is also playing a role in wearing a mask, right? And there's a threat of a sort of infinite regress here, which threatens to tear open the ground beneath people's feet. And as we were saying with the most important thing about a role is to appear self-convinced. If you once admitted that roles have no end as you question after their ground, you can't be self-convinced anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So,
yes.
But McLuhan didn't mind going into that vacuum. He didn't mind that sort of anxiety. And so one of the reasons that people turn out to be terrible readers of McLuhan is that it's forbidden for them to go into the no man's land, as he called it, where his thought is located. Right? They need to stay away from that cul-de-sac.
Right. Exploring ignorance for discovery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the ignorance in that term, exploring ignorance, is not something that, missed that quotation or something like that. It's a hole, that black hole that is underneath all of our identities. And so exploring that ignorance is not something that you do by publishing three consecutive articles on a theme in a certain journal. It has to do with taking the vacuity of human identity very, very seriously and asking what that has to do with genuine thinking.
Yeah, it's a spiritual act, what you're describing.
Absolutely. Right, right. And so, therefore, I myself don't believe that there's anything wrong with the topic of the medium is the message. It's just that used in a certain way, it covers over what it's trying to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, now I was going to say something. Exploring ignorance through discovery is a spiritual act. Yeah, the people are famous for specialist activities. A great soldier, great politician, a great lover, great athlete, and they may have said a few things like Yogi Berra would say silly things, or Babe Ruth said something, but nobody was known for a quotation. I don't think for an aphorism. Wordsworth was not known as, what do you do, child as father to the man? I think that was Wordsworth, or maybe Tennyson. But he made poetry. But in our speeded-up information society, the best you could be known for, and he was the first to do it, that's why he became famous, was to put out an aphorism. That's all society wanted. Give us something to guide us, so that we can continue phatically communicating and use your sentence, the medium is the message. Because you remember on the album, The Medium is a Massage, someone asked McLuhan about the phrase, what is it? He says, it's kind of like an aside. Think of that. It's an aside. Somebody's watching something, a parade or something with another person, and something happens in the parade, and so the guy says, or the woman says, hey, you know, it just shows you that's the way those people are. It's an aside, for freak's sake.
Yeah.
The medium is a message.
He wrote an essay about this in the 40s called The Case of the Missing Anecdote.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't published. I read it years ago. It has to do with how what you're calling an aside gets to the heart of communication, right? This is before he was really talking about communication. But the anecdote or the quotation or the aside is a very important aspect of what's going on in society at any given time, right? So it's, as you say, it's the phatic communication that's going on that nobody really knows that they're doing, nobody knows that they're understanding it, but it's happening. And so when he talks about the case of the missing anecdote, what he's saying is that there's no appreciation of that communication that is funny that there's no appreciation because that's all that's going on.
That's right. So he's taking a cliche and making it an archetype.
Right.
I mean, to
absolutely.
Say he became famous because he had the best aside of his lifetime. That's a good thing to say. New way to talk about McLuhan.
Yeah.
It's a confidential remark. It's a knowing. It's a knowing among a social bias, or about a social bias.
I would say expressing a social
bias. Yeah, but you're commenting on that. It's there. You're commenting on the ground. So
yes, I would say.
Yeah, so that's what was so much fun. You'd listen to McLuhan, listen to an album, and you conventionally think, okay, he's going to explain everything to me. And then you find out the big phrase, the meaning of the message, is just an aside. It's just something tossed off.
Right. And that's because in figure and ground or cliche and archetype, these can always flip.
Yes.
Right? So it can be an aside, but it can be very deep. It can be very deep, but it can be meaningless, right? And this dynamic, I believe, is what McLuhan was trying to get at.
Yeah. It was the cliche acts of society, of communication. And he wanted to make it noticeable, which turns it into archetype. So that's never talked about. The medium is a message. It's not an aphorism. It's an aside. Anyways, this is the first time I ever got to discuss this, other than maybe once or twice on the radio. But you're the first McLuhan scholar to discuss this with me. And you did a fine job of understanding it.
That actually leads into the page 40 stuff.
Okay.
If we can, let's go to your page 40, which is... 41, 42 of the PDF, and it's at the start of it, you have this Father Patrick Peyton quotation from Family Theater in 1971, and it's a quotation that you have at least twice or maybe three times in the course of your book.
It's the quotation, Cameron. They got me to today. That was, I don't know when I first discovered it, but, you know, it was recently because I think the interview was only made available recently, the past decade. But that was the key. That was the one. Look at him. You never heard that before. But I'm not sure what's the difference anymore. That's incredible.
Right. Right. And, but what I want to point out, Bob, is that become available after this is the very long, very detailed correspondence that McLuhan had with different people in the NAEB project, the National Association of Educational Broadcasters. So in 1959, I believe it is, I have this all set out in the post and in the blog and various posts, but in 1959, I believe he writes to Harry Scornia, and he says something like, remember, this is 1 year, 59 is 1 year after he began to talk about the medium as the message.
Yeah, so there are two, he says he said it in 57, other times he says it in 58. I don't know if that ever got resolved.
Yeah, I resolve it at the blog.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember how I resolve it between 57 and 58.
Well, do you find the actual broadcasting conference he went to?
Yes. Yeah. It was actually published. It was actually published.
Okay.
But it was published in a very obscure, hardly ever obtainable source. That was in May. I believe it was May of 1958 at a radio conference at UBC. And he later that same month, he went to an NAB-sponsored conference in Washington, D.C. That was co-sponsored by the Office of Education.
Yeah.
Within the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare.
Was it the Office of National Broadcasters?
The National Association of Educational Broadcasters.
Yeah.
That's NAEB.
Yes.
Right? So when McLuhan did what he called Understanding Media in 1960, which was the publication of his Project 69, that was financed by the United States Office of Education through the NAEB.
Yes.
So, and that was what then led on to Understanding Media in 1964. But in the course of developing his thoughts with the NAEB from 1958 on, he was constantly working on Gutenberg Galaxy at the same time.
Yes.
And in fact, he proposed that that Gutenberg Galaxy be used as a kind of preface to Project 69. And as I show at the blog, he frequently talked about progress on Gutenberg Galaxy in the context of Project 69. So it's interesting that Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media were sort of mixed up together starting probably in 1959, if not later part of 58, and then developed in tandem over the next 6 years.
Right. Now, let me add to that. What's interesting is that his main buddy, he always had a main buddy in these projects, was Harry Scornia.
Right.
You know, he's really important for getting connections and whatever for McLuhan.
Oh, hugely important.
Yeah.
He was a perfect sounding board.
Yeah.
He was able to lead McLuhan on in a way that McLuhan deeply appreciated. Most people have never seen